Welcome back to Shattering Myths. It is important that we recognize that Islam is intolerant of all religions, that in Islam it is appropriate, it is considered good for a Muslim to kill non-Muslims. And here in Somalia, that is exactly what they're doing. The only crime, and there was no trial, there was no actual evidence brought against either of these two women. Their alleged crime was being a Christian. It wasn't that they were out trying to promote Christianity. It wasn't that they were preaching Christianity. It wasn't that they were wearing any kind of Christian symbol. Their crime was that they didn't go to mosque often enough, and therefore they were assumed to be a Christian. And that was enough for the most fundamentalist Muslims in Somalia to murder them, cutting off their heads. Omar's daughters, ages 8 and 15, were forced to witness the mutilation of their mother. The younger girl screaming and shouting for someone to save her mother. The witnesses said, we're afraid that Al-Shabaab will continue to monitor the children and eventually kill them just like they did their mother. You know, how ruthless does Islam have to be before people finally shed their political correctness and say, you know, we ought not have this bumper sticker on the back of my Prius saying coexist with the Islamic symbol as one of their symbols that they are endorsing. When are people going to wake up to the savagery of this religion and to recognize that accepting it, tolerating it, promoting it, by doing these things, you're aiding and abetting the murder of women, their heads sawed off in front of their daughters. The militants from Al-Shabaab, which has vowed to rid the country of Christianity, met secretly to review cases of any person living in Somalia that they are suspicious might not be a good enough Muslim. In the case of Omar and Moog, these two women who were had their heads cut off in front of one of the women's children, their attendance at the mosque at Friday prayers was irregular. By the way, Muhammad said in the hadith of those who did not attend the mandated prayers at the mosque on Fridays, that the good Muslims should go and burn their homes down with them in it, burning them alive. The two people who were killed on the realization that they did not take, he says the two people were killed on this occasion because they did not take their Friday prayers seriously, especially Omar, who claimed that she was doing her prayers at her house, is what Al-Shabaab reported. Al-Shabaab, one resident noted, has spies everywhere in Somalia. They are the de facto government of Somalia. In the capital city of Mogadishu last October, gunmen who said they intended to kill a Christian for spreading his faith shot him to death. Two men armed with pistols on October 20th shot Hassan seven times as he approached his home after closing his pharmacy. He was survived by his wife, who was pregnant, and five children, ranging from 3 to 12. The Somali cell of Al-Qaeda, and there's no association between the lads, Al-Shabaab and Al-Qaeda, only a direct association with Islam, the Quran, and Hadith, murdered Fatuma Ersk Ilmi, 35, on September 1st of 2013 inside of her home in south-central Somalia. Her husband had received a threat, a note, that morning from the Islamic extremist group, but was away at the time of his wife's murder. Al-Shabaab's attack on an upscale Westgate shopping mall in Nairobi, Kenya. Remember that? September 20th, 2013. Al-Shabaab, this fundamentalist Islamic group, murdered 67 innocent people. Dozens are still unaccounted for, buried in the rubble. How many people must Islam murder before we hold Islam accountable? Before we impeach a president of the United States when he goes to the leading Islamic university and praises Islam for its great contributions to humankind, calling it a great religion. On April 13th of last year, Al-Shabaab militants shot Fartoon Omar to death in northern Somalia. Omar was the widow of Mursal Esti Said, who was killed for his faith in December of 2012. North of Mogadishu. He had been receiving death threats for leaving Islam. Now, his crime was not to be a Christian. It was for leaving Islam. The Quran says that if a Muslim rejects Islam, kill him. Right there in the Quran. Now, you'd think that with these murders based on someone abrogating Islam, that somebody would have quoted that verse. They are journalists, after all. But no. Said in his wife, who later converted to Christianity, had moved to an area that was under government control, not under the control of Al-Shabaab. And the government of Somalia murdered them. On June 7th of 2013, in southern Somalia, that says insurgents, let's just read fundamentalist Muslims, shot a 28-year-old named Hassan Hirsch to death after alleging that he was a Christian. They brought Hirsch to a public square in the town of Jilib and shot him in the head. On February 18th of 2013, Islamist extremists, they write, shot Ahmed Ali Jamali, a 42-year-old father of four, to death on the outskirts of the coastal city of Kismayo. In Barara, Al-Shabaab militants killed a Christian after accusing him of being a spy and of leaving Islam. They beheaded the 25-year-old Farhan Haji Moshe, after monitoring his movements for 6 months. He drew suspicion when he returned to Somalia after spending some time in Kenya, because Kenya's population is 83% Christian, while Somalia's is essentially 100% Islamic. You know, it's amazing that Bill Clinton thought that it would be a smart idea to send American troops to support a UN mission to feed the starving people of Somalia, who were starving because of these terrorist organizations, because they weren't working, and because the youth were joining the terrorist gangs, that would be a good idea. And what happened? These terrorist gangs, these fundamentalist Muslims, butchered the Americans who had been sent them to help supervise the distribution of food. You can't help these people. You know, when God spoke of the return of his people to the promised land and said, you know, that he was not willing to rid the promised land of the religious people that were there initially because their iniquity, their depravity was not to the point that it was unsalvageable. But later it reached the point where they were beyond hope. That's what happens with Islam. Muslims are beyond hope. Now, there are some bad Muslims, some Muslims who were born into Islam, who were actually desirous of knowing the truth. And it's one of the reasons that Prophet of Doom is extremely popular in places like Iran. where bad Muslims will read it and where they will come to know the truth and come to reject Islam. But a good Muslim, they can't be saved. If you meet a good Muslim, given the opportunity, they will be a terrorist. In fact, it is, according to the Quran, impossible to be a good Muslim and not be a terrorist. That's what the Ninth Surah says. Read it. A suicide bomb in northern Afghanistan killed 15 people, including women and children. This is from the BBC. Another 27 were wounded in the attack. The bomber detonated his explosives near the entrance of a busy market. It's the nature of Islam. Muslims kill Muslims in far greater numbers than they kill non-Muslims. The attack comes as the Afghanis are preparing to hold presidential elections. And by the way, if you go through the years that the Taliban ran Afghanistan, and if you were to accumulate the number of terrorist atrocities, the number of people killed and mutilated in a Islamic terrorist attack, over the 5 years that the Taliban ruled over Afghanistan before the American invasion, you wouldn't have as many people killed and wounded as on this one day in this one place. The American invasion of Afghanistan did not serve to diminish terrorism, but instead exacerbate it. The attack comes as they're preparing now to hold these presidential elections. No group has claimed credit for the bombing. However, Taliban insurgents and the... Now, how can they be insurgents if they're in control of the country? And the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan are active in the region. Now, it's the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan. Now, when they call themselves the Islamic movement, just like the terrorist group in Iraq and Syria calls themselves the Islamic State, do you think that maybe they're trying to tell us that their affinity is with Islam? Might we call them Islamic terrorists under those circumstances, or is that way too sensitive? Well, the United Nations has said that 2,959 civilians were killed and 5,656 were wounded in Afghanistan last year alone. Welcome back to Shattering Mitzvah. A month ago, we reported a story of how cancer was growing at about, I think the number was 47% worldwide, and that it was an epidemic worldwide. The interesting thing about the article on cancer, before we turn to this article from CNN on projected cancer rise in the United States, is that that most of the occurrence of cancer was preventable. It was a direct response. Most people that got the cancers that were the most prevalent got them because they smoked cigarettes, because they were obese, and because they didn't exercise. It's cancer, which is, you know, it's a normal cell that that just begins to replicate itself aggressively. There's lots of triggers, and many of the triggers occur when we don't take good care of ourselves, when we're just not responsible, don't eat appropriately, don't exercise appropriately, and engage in bad behavior, like, for example, smoking. And so it's my view, and I'm going to share this article with you because there's the rise in cancer is projected to be 45% in the United States, is going to bankrupt the Medicare, Medicaid program. And Medicaid the government are therefore going to be paying hundreds of thousands of dollars each year to people who just didn't take responsibility for themselves. You know, my view is that if you choose to smoke and you get lung cancer, and you have the money to treat the lung cancer, and you can pay the doctor, and you can pay the hospital, go ahead and do so. That's stupid that you smoked. But, you know, you want to spend your money to fix the problem you brought on yourself, that's okay. But when the government is forced to resolve someone's stupidity, I got a real problem with that. When somebody is on food stamps and is obese, I got a real problem with that. And much of what we're going to consider here is a result of people no longer taking responsibility and of being completely dependent upon government. Well, this article from CNN reads, in 16 years, cancer will become the leading cause of death in the United States, surpassing heart disease, according to a new report by the American Society of Clinical Oncology. The number of new cancer cases is expected to increase by 45%, from 1.6 million cases to 2.3 million cases annually. Well, actually, my friends, by this time, and they're thinking that the peak here is going to be 2030. Asteroid strikes, volcanic landslide tsunamis, earthquakes, hurricanes, tornadoes, famine, pandemics, and world war, one of which is going to be caused by the United States, are going to dwarf cancer as a cause of death. This influx of new patients, this article reads, will place a bigger burden on the field of medicine already stretched by physician shortages and financial difficulties, says the report, which highlights the growing problems for cancer care in the United States. We are producing fewer doctors than we are producing patients. Now, a lot of that is because it is no longer rewarding to be a doctor. The Affordable Care Act did not deal with the two most expensive aspects of healthcare in America are malpractice insurance and the cost of malpractice. And number two, the FDA in terms of the cost of bringing a drug to the market. Those are the two biggest expenses. Neither one which was addressed during the Affordable Care Act, and therefore health care is more expensive than it was previously. A friend of mine, close friend, is a orthopedic surgeon. He's my age and therefore is in his late 50s. When he went into private practice, at the time that he went into private practice, about 90% of the doctors graduating medical school and fulfilling their residency requirements went into private practice. Today, 90% of those who graduate from medical school go to work for large healthcare providers. They're no longer in private practice. A 90% in favor of private industry through large conglomerates over a 25-year period. I couldn't help but miss the statement by one of the advertisers that you should consider their firm because they are Christian and veteran. And that in addition to providing food, they provide Bibles. Yeah, to advertise that way, they're paying money, betting that Christian and veteran are viewed in harmony as both favorable and both consistent. So you can be a veteran. A veteran is someone who is now is someone who chooses of their own volition to join a branch of the U.S. military whereby they are trained to kill. And Christian, perfect harmony. No problem at all to see this unification of these two things and to view them favorably, according to the advertiser. Perhaps that's wrong, but with one of the many things that's wrong with Christianity, one of the many things that's wrong with militantism and patriotism and how it gets us in so much trouble. People unable to see the conflict between these things. Returning to the story on cancer and the fact that we have not enough doctors, the realization is that the influx of new patients, according to this report, is going to place a huge burden on the physician because there's going to be a tremendous physician shortage. And this is across the board. A lot of it is directly related to the fact that malpractice insurance is unaffordable, that it's cost too much money to be a doctor in private practice. You can't make the kind of living that would be appropriate with 8 or 9 or 10 years of post high school education, where you not get your undergraduate degree in 4 years, you go to medical school, it's another 6 years, and then another couple of years of residency. You're paying for all of that. You can't go into that field and have your income eaten up by malpractice insurance. And running an office now, particularly with all of the rules that government has and burdens that government has imposed on employers, providing for health insurance coverage and the burden of the Social Security tax and the like. You can't make a living at it. And so there's just no reason to do it anymore. With oncology services needing growing at 42%, the number of oncologists is expected to grow at half that rate. Drug prices are another big concern, according to the report. When the author of the report started practicing, the average cancer drug cost $1,000 per month. Today, the average is $10,000 a month. Now, part of that is the fact that we've devalued our currency. And so that a significant part of that is just the money's not worth what money used to be worth because we've mismanaged our currency. But part of that is because of the exorbitant cost of the FDA. You know, it costs $1 billion to put a drug through the FDA. You can't do that and charge an affordable price for the drug without going broke. So when, you know, I hear so many commercials on this network that blame the pharmaceutical companies for abusive pricing. Well, if you eliminated the $1 billion cost of the approval of the drug, then there would be lots more drugs available, and their cost would be hugely diminished. And if you eliminated the cost of malpractice associated with providing drugs, the cost would fall through the floor. It would be just a tiny percentage of what they currently cost. That's how you take the cost out of the system. Yeah, would there be some people that would suffer an adverse effect? Yes. But how many more would benefit from having new drugs brought to market? A pharmaceutical company today may have a marvelous drug that targets some form of cancer. Now, that has triggers that work in the hypoxic environment of a cancer cell, delivering the remedy to the heart of the cancer as opposed to, you know, subjecting a person to chemotherapy and killing healthy and cancerous cells, making them ill. Great cost. And yet, they're not going to bring that drug to market unless they believe that they can make a return on the $1 billion cost of getting it approved. And even then, they have to charge enough for it to cover the back-end malpractice suits that we brought against them by some minority of those who take the drug and are adversely affected. You know, there isn't anything that is perfect. There's consequences associated with everything. And, you know, we have just priced ourselves into oblivion, where healthcare is not affordable because of the stupidity of the systems surrounding it. The malpractice insurance costs and the government regulations, particularly in drug approval. that's what needed to be done in healthcare. As opposed to, as in addition to that, to saying that, you know, as a society, if someone is injured and breaks their arm and can't afford to have their arm set, then through the most efficient means possible, which would probably be urgent care centers, the non-hospital settings, the government ought to pay those doctors a reasonable price and those facilities a reasonable price to set that person's arm. You know, if somebody has a contagious disease of which antibiotics are helpful, give them the antibiotics and have the government reimburse them for that. But if somebody is has got cancer and it's going to cost $10,000 a month, therefore $120,000 just for the cancer care drugs, and they're unwilling to pay for it, why should it be society's burden? This article says, if we don't begin to control these prices. Now, how do you control these prices? Now, are you going to impose more regulations to make the healthcare industry less efficient? Control these prices. Yeah, there's a way to control these prices. One is to stop devaluing your currency through quantitative easing and the Federal Reserve. Second, stop deficit spending, which destroys the value of your currency. So you spend less money with the government. Three, you eliminate the malpractice cost associated with the drugs. And number four, you eliminate this $1 billion cost of getting drug approval. That's how you bring those prices down. He said one way or another, in 20 years, the average cost of a cancer drug will be $100,000 a month. And the government's supposed to pay for that? And when you realize that the majority of cancers are with older people that are covered in Medicare, he says, this report says that's not sustainable. The 20% copay on $10,000 a month is not in the pocketbook for most of this person's patients. No. And they're expecting the government to pick up the rest? And that's not a problem. Brawley said that the price is one of the biggest reasons that there's such a disparity in cancer outcome. Research shows minorities are more likely to develop cancer and more likely to die from cancer. Well, I'm telling you that the cost of treating cancer isn't contributing to a minority group's greater likelihood of getting cancer. Now, the fact that they're more likely to die of cancer may also be directly associated with their genetic disposition or cultural disposition in terms of their diet and exercise plans to get the cancer in the first place. Speaking of bad behavior, and the bad behavior having no correlation with one's race or wealth, Irsay, who is the owner of the Indianapolis Colts, the NFL franchise, he faces four felony charges. The Colts owner, Jim Irsay, was charged with four felony accounts of possession of a controlled substance after being arrested late Sunday on suspicion of intoxicated driving. He's the misdemeanor charge, which is driving while intoxicated. It's amazing that that's a misdemeanor charge, because that is the very thing that puts people at risk. You know, somebody owning, and these were prescription drugs, but it's not a felony to own prescription drugs if they are prescribed for you. But the fact that having possession of a prescription drug without having the prescription is a felony, but operating a vehicle that can kill others while intoxicated is a misdemeanor, tells you that there's something seriously wrong with our society. This is an interesting case, however, for the NFL, which suspends players for anywhere from four games for the first offense of using marijuana and not of reckless driving while under the influence of marijuana, just recreationally using marijuana, and we'll suspend them for an entire season for a second offense of using marijuana. And now they've got a owner of an NFL franchise with four felony counts of possession of a controlled substance and driving having failed four roadside sobriety tests. What are they going to do with him to maintain any credibility with their players? I have another item in the news that I wanted to share with you. We have become a police state, and the police are acting with greater recklessness. There was a dash cam that you can view this on YouTube. It's been posted there. You know how the police now have these dash cams? Well, it shows footage of a police deputy shooting an elderly man to death. This elderly guy, they pulled the car over. The elderly man got out of his car using his cane. He was kind of hobbled over, turned towards the police officer, his cane pointed straight down to the ground as he's trying to say, okay, Mr. Officer, you know, why did you pull me over? And the police officer shot him dead, killed him right there. So, oh, you know, I thought his cane was a shotgun. This is not acceptable, folks. Yesterday on Shattering This, we considered this transition in Yeshaya Isaiah 17, where God is telling us that there will be a horrible war in Syria, that Damascus, which was the longest inhabited city in world history, would become a tangled heap of ruins, that there'd be marauding gangs of terrorists eventually without anyone left to terrorize, and that not only would Damascus fall, but so would the Syrian government. But in addition, there would be collateral damage, and he spoke of the fallout occurring in both Lebanon and in Jordan. Exact things that we're witnessing today. Then he said, out of this, as a result of this, on that day, in that day, at this time, it will also come to pass that the size of Jacob, this is speaking of a unified Israel, Israel, will be decreased to the point of no longer being sustainable or viable. And that the fattest, best protected, and most important place of his body shall be leaned. And one of the items in today's news is that the Israelis are doing that dreaded, hateful, and violent thing again, that oppressive thing where they're building homes in Jerusalem. Well, Jerusalem, much of it's going to be taken away from them. And much of their land will be taken away. They're going to be thinned so that they're about 5 miles wide where most of the people live. It is a frightening eventuality. And we were talking yesterday, we considered a lot of historical evidence as to how, when this prophecy was first shared, how it just would have been inconceivable for God to say that Israel is going to be thinned at the waist. Because there was no Israel. I mean, at this point, what was considered Israel, which was the northern kingdom, was gone. It had been brought down, the people hauled away into captivity by the Assyrians. We went through that yesterday. And even Yehuda was on its last breath. There was 185,000 Assyrian troops bearing down on the city. And the city of Jerusalem looked for all the world as if it too were going to succumb to the Assyrians. It was the last hurrah for a unified Israel. Now the kingdom of Yehuda, it did survive the initial Assyrian assault, and partly because the small nation capitulated and it became a vassal state. But some 20 years later, Hezekiah, as king of Judah, of Yehuda, he sought to end the nation's subservience to the Assyrians. And he stopped paying the tribute tax that was imposed. By the way, this tribute tax that exists in Islam, it has its roots in pagan Assyria. The Egyptians were turned to next as the king tried to find an ally to keep the Assyrians at bay. But the Egyptians proved unreliable. And so in the fourth year of Shanacherib, 701 BCE, Yehuda, Judah, was isolated. It was defenseless. And that was of great concern because, as I said, there were 185,000 Assyrian soldiers marching in their direction with the express intent of plundering what was little was left of that great kingdom that Dodd had built. As it would transpire, what happened next serves as an extraordinarily important lesson for us, just as it was for people of all time. Because what Hezekiah did is that he found a copy of the Torah and he read it. This is God's instructions to us, his guidance. And God provides guidance. It says, if you will come to know who I am and understand what I'm offering, and you will accept the terms and conditions of my covenant relationship, I'll protect you. I'll empower you. I'll enrich you. I'll cause all good things to happen to you. And I have a specific plan that if you'll just follow this plan, all of the benefits that you could possibly imagine will be yours. You will not have to rely on anyone else. As a matter of fact, I don't want you to rely on anyone. Just rely on me, and I will see to it that you are protected. Well, Hezekiah said, you know, the Egyptians didn't turn out to be very reliable. He paid his bribe to the Assyrian king, and the Assyrian king said, oh, yeah, that was very nice, but thank you very much. We're still going to plunder you and drive you into submission. He had tried his military. He had tried all manner of things, and they had proven to be wholly unreliable. And he said, boy, I'm reading this story, and this God seems very credible, and he's got this plan, some guidance on how we can rely on him. Why don't we give that a try?